Okay, so I gave you this handout. We're not going to go through this handout tonight. This is for your own edification or your own throwaway occasion, whatever you would like to call it. But this is something I've kind of alluded to, and we'll talk about some of the material in here tonight, which is an interpretive key to 1 and 2 Samuel. Now, generally, when you listen to commentators, the standard line is that 1 and 2 Samuel and the book of Ruth are all written by probably several authors and one compiler, right? It's called 1 Samuel because Samuel is the main character. That's kind of a tradition among the Hebrew naming practices, is that the main character or one of the main characters would be the title person, but that doesn't necessarily mean it's the author. So people have proposed various names for the author. People have suggested Samuel, obviously, that Samuel wrote the earlier portions. Other people have mentioned David as one of the authors, which is possible, unlikely, I think. Nathan the prophet, Gad the prophet, maybe one of the later priests who served under David, instead of one of the prophets, one of the, my mind's drawn a blank, but other priests, people within the Davidic court could have written 1 and 2 Samuel and Ruth, but they seem to be united as a unit. They seem to be a group of texts that had a single author, or at least a single compiler, and a single purpose, and it's largely believed and generally understood that the purpose of Ruth and 1 and 2 Samuel is to and Judges as well, is that to show this is what happens when Israel has no king, this is what happens when Israel has a bad king, and this is what happens when Israel has David as a king. So it's viewed through this very political lens that this is all, propaganda is the wrong word, but it's like theological propaganda where, like, David is God's king, and so this is what happens when God's king is on the throne. And that's kind of the standard line, and I think that that's at least worth considering, and I think that there's probably a great amount of truth to it. But I wanted to offer a different interpretive key. So if you read that this article, you'll see that I have a theory that everything stems back from Hannah's prayer, that God takes the humble, God lifts up the humble and seats them on thrones of grace. The word throne and the word grace, thrones of glory. The word throne and the word glory are very important words in 1 Samuel especially, and then 2 Samuel as well. So there's a theory that the whole of probably the latter part of Judges, well, all of Judges, Ruth, 1 and 2 Samuel, the theme is that God takes the humble and he gives them thrones of grace. He gives them authority and power. He lifts up the humble. And that if we use that as an interpretive key, maybe that helps sort out what's going on in 1 and 2 Samuel, why the events that are chosen have been chosen, why the author chooses to talk about Abigail and Nabal, for instance. I mean, it's a great story. Everybody loves the story of Abigail, but how does that really advance the narrative? It doesn't. You read the story and you're like, oh, Abigail, this is the wife David should have married. And I think she was. But this is the wife David should have married. But then she has like two kids that nobody cares about and she fades out of the story. So why tell that story at all? Is the story to show us the flaw in David's character? That David was in great measure a warlord? That he was willing to live by the customs of the people? Or is it to show that David could be dissuaded from doing acts of incredible violence? Or is it to show David is not the main character in that story? David he's just there. And Abigail doesn't really play any part. So why is that in there? Well, I think that the interpretive key I'm offering you guys will maybe help explain why the author has chosen to include the events that the author did. But anyways, that's neither here nor there. Tonight, the death of Eli, the Philistines capture the ark. I'm assuming and presuming that everybody's already read the text. So with that presumption, I'm going to give a really brief overview of it. Does somebody else want to give kind of an overview? Is anybody else bold and brave and ready to do a summary of chapter 4 of 1 Samuel? Anyways, so I'm going to give a really brief overview, and then we're gonna start talking about the text. So here's what happens. As we know, the story of Samuel is kind of a continuation of what we've read in Ruth. There's Israel, which is really a continuation of the Judges. Samuel is this little boy who's born to a barren woman. He is, at a very young age, he is given to the temple, but the temple is ruled by Eli, who's a do-nothing, and his two wicked sons, Hophni and Phinehas. They are bad dudes. And there is the cult of Yahweh, the temple. They're calling it a temple, by the way. It's important to notice that. It's called a temple. And the fact that it's called a temple, a lot of people have pointed to that. Forgive me for this little aside. A lot of people pointed to the fact that it's called a temple and said, no. This wasn't written in the time that it was. See, because it's called a temple, this is proof that this is written later and then just pretended to be written earlier. Because the temple wasn't built. They had the tabernacle at this point. It was the tabernacle at Shiloh. And so people have pointed that. I don't think that's the case. I think that it's called the temple because it functioned as the temple, and people believed that the tabernacle would stay in Shiloh forever, that Shiloh was the place that God had appointed, and that's why it's called the temple. I think that's significant, and we'll see why in just a little bit. So Hophni and Phinehas are there. The cult is corrupted. God has sent one prophet to tell Eli that the house of Eli is going to fall. Eli does nothing. He does not respond in any meaningful way at all. His sons, when he does give them this like weak sauce rebuke, his sons do not respond in any meaningful way at all. And the text tells us in chapter late 2 or early 3, I forget, the text tells us that they did nothing because God had determined in his heart to put them to death. It pleased God to put them to death is what the text literally says. And so they do nothing. But God is raising up a priest for himself. He is raising up Samuel, who is going to be the priest of the Lord. He is going to be the priest who does what's right. He is going to faithfully handle God's word. He is going to be recognized, as we see at the end of chapter 3. He is recognized from Dan to Beersheba. He is a priest and a prophet, and no word that he speaks falls to the ground. And all of Israel recognizes him as a prophet. And so even as a very young man, Samuel is really recognized as the real spiritual leader in the nation. Not Eli, the blind old priest. Not his two corrupt sons. It's Samuel, the little boy wearing a linen ephod, who all of Israel recognizes as the actual spiritual leader of the nation. And then we come to chapter 4. In chapter 4 enters, and there's once again battle with the Philistines. And I say once again because we really haven't had this since Samson, right? I mean, we have Samson in the latter part of the Judges, and then we have those, and so in Judges we have Samson, and then we have these two historical stories. These two stories that are just taken out of the context and just dropped in there because they summarize the story of the Judges. And then we have Ruth, and then we have the first three chapters of Samuel. And then we talk about the Philistines, and you're kind of thinking, oh man, I forgot that those people were there, the Philistines. Yeah, those are bad guys. Well, the Philistines have camped at Aphek. They've set up camp, and the Israelites come and they set up their camp. Now remember, Israel has no king. Eli is the judge. Israel has no king. They have nobody to rally the troops. So the Israelites who come are probably a very small local army, and they set up camp opposite them. And then the Israelites get an idea. They're like, wait a second. What if we bring the Ark of the Lord? What if we take the Ark of the Covenant and we take the Ark of the Covenant into battle with us, and then God will be with us? Okay, so already their theology is quite questionable. And so they come to the priests. And what do Hophni and Phinehas say? Hey, that's a great idea, guys. Let's take that Ark and let's go. And so they take it and they go. And we could talk all night on why they chose to go, but okay, we'll be done with it right now then. And so Hophni and Phinehas, they decide that they're going to go, and so they bring the Ark of the Lord, and then you got to love what the Philistines say. I can't help this. I have to actually read it. So the Philistines line up for battle. The Israelites, there's this huge shout from the Israelite camp when they see the Ark of the Covenant, because the Israelites believe Yahweh is here with us, and Yahweh, as a fighter, has an undefeated record. He doesn't lose fights. And so this is what the Philistines say. The Philistines were afraid. A god has come into the camp, they said. We're in trouble. Nothing like this has happened before. Woe to us. Who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? They are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all kinds of plagues in the desert. Be strong, Philistines. Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. be men and fight. So the Philistines know the history. They know that Egypt was brought low by God. They must also know the history of how Israel invaded Canaan and conquered the vast majority of Canaan, except for the seacoast where the Philistines live, on that western shore of the Mediterranean, or I guess that'd be eastern shore, west of the... Anyways. So the Philistines, instead of saying, we can't fight a god, they say, hey, let's be men. Come on, guys, let's do it. Let's rally together, and let's go beat this god. What? They're gonna go fight a bunch of gods? Yeah, they're going to. The Philistines, when they're confronted with this, their response, again, we could do a whole Bible study series on this. Their response is, yeah, let's go fight. Let's fight even harder. Otherwise, we'll become slaves of the Israelites. So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So God has fulfilled the prophecy against Hophni and Phinehas. Then, as we know, runners come back. They bring news to Eli, and Eli is sitting on a throne by the roadside. Again, I mentioned this in my sermon. You notice every time we run into Eli, he's sitting on a throne doing nothing. He's just sitting there waiting for news. And a runner comes up and tells him, he says, verse 16, I've just come from the battle line. I fled from it this very day. What happened, my son? The man said, I fled before Philistine. The army has suffered heavy losses. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the ark of God has been captured. When he mentioned the ark of God, Eli fell backward off his throne by the side of the gate. His neck was broken, and he died, for he was an old man and heavy. He had led Israel 40 years. That word heavy, that's what this whole, that whole handout I gave you, heavy is the same word for glory. He was sitting on a throne of glory. Remember what Hannah said? Because the Hebrew word kavod, it's kavod or kaved, however you want to pronounce it, it can mean, the verb means to make something heavy, and that's the same word for to glorify something. When in the Hebrew mind, if you make something glorious, you're making it weighty, you're making it heavy. Well, here's Eli, the do-nothing Eli, sitting on a throne, an old fat guy, and he falls and he snaps his neck. I mean, he's 98. I mean, necks break when you're 98, so I'm not, it happens, right? At least once, you know, like, and so he dies, and he had led Israel 40 years. Now, wait a second. He had led Israel 40 years. Where do we hear that language, he led Israel? We read, that's the judges. Every time a judge dies, we read, he led Israel X years. Eli is a judge. In fact, that's literally the expression that's used earlier. Eli and his sons, they judged Israel. Now his daughter-in-law, the wife of Phinehas, was pregnant and near the time of delivery. When she heard the news that the ark had been captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she went into labor and gave birth, but was overcome by her labor pains. As she was dying, the women attending her said, "Don't despair, you've given birth to a son." Well, good news, right? Like, you gotta love midwives, right? Like, it's like, listen, baby girl, I know you're literally dying from pain right now, but you got a son, so there's something for you. But she did not respond or pay attention, as you would expect someone not to. She named the boy Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel. Because of the capture of the ark of God and the deaths of her father-in-law and her husband," she said, "the glory has departed from Israel, for the ark of God has been captured." Ichabod is the name Ichabod. No kavod, no glory. Kavod, the same word for fat, for heavy, the heaviness of Eli that killed him. So this is very deliberate punning that's happening. The author of 1 Samuel, this isn't just an accident that it just works out this way. He's making a point. Israel has no glory because the ark of the Lord has been captured and the priesthood is gone. But this raises a question. And this is the question I'll start with tonight. Was the glory gone? Had the glory departed? What do you think, Jim? You look like you want to say something. No, you don't want to say something, or Okay. Had the glory departed from Israel, what were her dying words? And by the way, I mean, that's kind of a mean name to give your kid, right? Like, but was she right? Had the glory departed from Israel? Jean says no. Why not? Okay. So you're saying God is everywhere and that the glory hadn't departed from Israel. You're saying that God would have honored his covenant with Abraham. Sure, sure. No, I'm not dismissing it. Right. So the question is, why did she believe that the glory had departed? So? I'm not dismissing you. I'm just saying, like, why did that matter to her? Okay. So the visible glory of the Lord is with the ark. But why does that matter? And I'm not arguing with you. I'm saying if what Gene says is true, and I think that the Israelites had every reason to believe that God was a global deity, at least from what Moses has said, they should know this. He's a global deity. He is not limited to being in time or space because of the way he struck Egypt. But did the Israelites at this time, or at least did this woman believe that he was a global deity who was not limited to time and space? Yeah, I mean, it certainly seems like she believes that God is limited to things. God is either he's limited to the ark, or he's limited to the priesthood, to the people who offer him worship and sacrifice. And I mean, the question is okay, well, your husband is sleeping around with all these girls at the temple. And by the way, it seems like, I mean, she wasn't really that upset that her husband died. I mean, I don't know. That's how I read that text. But she is upset that her father-in-law is dead and that the ark is gone. And to her, the end of the priesthood, because it doesn't, I mean, the text in 1 Samuel is really obscure because it doesn't give us a lot of information. We don't know how many other priests are working there. Were there any other priests or Levites functioning at the temple? You would certainly think there had to be, right? I mean, for three people to manage that kind of sacrifice, even at a small scale, would have to be enormously difficult. They had to have assistance. But who's ready to take on the role? Who's ready to continue the priesthood? Is anybody? We don't know. The text doesn't tell us. We don't know. So her understanding of the glory of God is that God meets with the people in the ark. But it's strange that if God meets with them in the ark, and this is so important to their nation, why do they just take it to battle? I mean, was it just the belief that it made them invincible, that it was some kind of amulet or some kind of it had magical properties that would protect them? I don't know. But if it was captured by the Philistines, then was God tied to the ark in the first place? I mean, if the ark is the visible symbol of God's presence, and the ark, or maybe that the ark encapsulates God's presence, then how can the ark be captured? And if the ark is captured, and it is the center, the physical encapsulation of God's presence, then what does it mean for Israel if their God is captured? Anyways, we're getting a little, I'm getting a little deep into this. But there's a lot here. There's a lot of presuppositions. There's a preacher, and I forget who he is, so I won't go into that, but he said that there are two major errors that people make about God, and they say there are two heresies, the heresy of hereness and the heresy of thereness. And they say that the heresy of hereness is God is here and nowhere else. Like, you have to go to a church. You know, I remember, you know, somebody told me once, I happened to use a bad word at a church, and they said, you can't use a bad word at church. And I said, why? Because it's church. I said, well, can I walk out the door and cuss? And they said, well, that's okay. I said, okay. So God is here, but he's not there, right? Well, the other one is, so that's the heresy of hereness. And that's kind of what Gurley here had. You know, God is here. He is at the tabernacle. He's at the temple. He is at the ark. God is only at the ark. If you want to meet with God, you have to go to the ark. He's here. He's not there. So that's the heresy of hereness. Now, the heresy of thereness is what Jonah had, right? Or at least people say Jonah had. Like, God's not there. Or God's there, so I'm going to go over here. God will not follow me. They're kind of the same thing, but they're a little bit different. But Jonah's saying, I'm going to run away from the Lord. I'm going to run away from where Yahweh is. Now, I don't believe that Jonah actually believed that, but that's what people say is what Jonah was doing, so it works for the purposes of the illustration. But people do that, right? I'm going to run away from God. It's like saying, I'm going to run away from air. Like, where are you going to go? Where can you go? David asks, where can I go to flee from your presence? If I go to heaven, you're there. If I go down to the depths, you're there also. Hades is not beyond his reach. So we have that. So anyways, what are we thinking here? What are we taking from this text? It's been a lot of me talking so far. I want to hear what you guys, what stands out to you? Yeah. So I'm gonna ask a question back to you though. Because you're right. But then if you take that position to an extreme, you get people who have, well, I don't need to go to church to have a relationship with God. So you get that attitude of well, God is everywhere, and I can pray to God however I want, and I don't need to go to church to be a Christian. I don't need to be around a bunch of hypocrites. Well, what do we respond? What if they use this text? And I'm not saying you're interpreting this wrongly. What if they use this text and say, look, the foolish Israelites, they thought that God was, that you had to go to a place to meet with God, and God let the ark to be captured to prove to them that God is not tied to a box. I don't need to go to church. How would you respond? Well, what if, and I'm just playing devil's advocate here. What if somebody says, well, yeah, but I don't need to go to a church. I don't need to be associated in a church. I can go and meet with my Christian friends as we have, you know, coffee at Seasons, and that's all the church I need, or I can fellowship on YouTube with, you know, Pastor Pillow or whatever his name is. How do you respond to that? Because, I mean, they're kind of fellowshipping with other believers. They're not forsaking it. How do we respond to that? Why can't you just do that all at Seasons? They didn't need the priesthood. No, I agree with you. I'm just saying, like, what, I mean, fine, I'm arguing with you. Well, what? How do you? Yeah, obviously, I'm against going to church, so that's my whole shtick. But what, Phineas? Can you lay down, bud, please? So what's different about going to church than meeting for Bible study at somebody's home or going to Seasons or what? How is this different than that? Aw, the blizzard of hugs I'm waiting for. Obviously, this is a bad audience to ask. Does Bible study in your home replace church? Are you asking me or are you asking everybody else? I think it's a really good question. The problem is that there are, at least one of the problems is that there are at least four different ways. I wanted to count them in my head to make sure I had them right. There are at least four different ways that church is used in the Bible. And sometimes church seems to be used. So you have the church mysterious, or the church universal, right? And that's the church universal. And that's all believers who are alive on earth right now. There's the church mysterious, or the church eternal. And that is the church of all believers at all times. So even dead believers and future believers, because God is eternal. So you've got that. Then you've got the church local, which would be a church in its iteration of believers, which is, you know, what you talked about. It's the people in a specific place at a specific time. And then you have something kind of like, I don't know that there's a term for it, but I'm just going to call it the church formal, where Matthew 18 in particular seems to use it this way when Jesus says, if not, take it to the church. And Paul talks about, when he talks about ordinances for the church, he doesn't seem to be using that in the sense of just the collection of local believers, like the believers in Bryan. Because when he writes to the Corinthians, he's probably writing to several churches. So when he says to the church in Corinth, He's saying, I'm writing to all people who are born again in Jesus Christ who live in the city of Corinth, even though they happen to be in several different churches, several different units of the body of Christ. So you have the church in Brian, but you also have churches in Brian, because the churches in Brian are like the church formal, where we have bylaws and ordinances. We have pastors. We have officers. We have a formalized structure that allows us to do, I think, at least two things that you cannot get from meeting in Seasons, or sitting at home watching YouTube or whatever. And the two distinctives that I would suggest, I think, have to go together to be rightly done. There is proper church discipline, or at least there should be proper church discipline, and there are the sacraments. You cannot have the sacraments without church discipline. And without the sacraments, church discipline is a country club, right? You have to have both. The problem is that Americans, because the West has fallen in love with the Enlightenment, and because the West has fallen in love with modernism, we have elevated the intellect so high above the body and so high above everything else that we tend to think that physically meeting together, several of you mentioned that, physically meeting together is unimportant. Because what really matters is that I'm reading my Bible. Yeah, your Bible's important, but you know what? For the first 1,600 years of the church, nobody owned a Bible. There was one in the church, or very wealthy patrons would have a copy of the Bible. But there was monumentally high rates of illiteracy. People had to memorize the scripture that they heard. They came up with stories to learn the Bible. But Bible study was not the primary means through which they lived out their spiritual life. They lived out through fellowship and the sacraments and acts of piety and acts of righteousness. And we've forgotten that, and we've fallen into a form of Gnosticism where the body is bad. The body is bad. The body is just something that's hindering us. It's keeping us from real spirituality. If only we could get rid of this body, we would be like God and we would be perfect. So we've just got to trudge along with these crummy little bodies until we die. And then our soul, it's Platonism, our soul will be set free. Well, that's what American evangelicals believe. You don't need to be properly baptized. You don't need to celebrate communion. You don't need proper church discipline, because those are physical things. You don't need to pray on your knees. You don't need to fast, because that's just the body. What matters is, have you memorized your Awana verses? Do you listen to John Piper? That's what matters. Well, that's a pretty paltry faith. So I'm just preaching at everybody, but what I guess what I'm trying to point out is, when we talk to people, and oh, by the way, everybody's answers I thought were really good. When we talk to people and they say, well, I don't need to go to church, what's really behind that are an enormous set of presuppositions. And the biggest presupposition is what I do physically has nothing to do with who I am and what I'm becoming spiritually. And that's a lie from hell. That is a satanic lie. What you do physically does matter spiritually. The person is a unit. You cannot simply just separate the body away from the spirit and the soul. They are integrated. And so, if I pray standing up with my eyes open, I'm not saying you can't pray that way. I pray that way sometimes myself. But to pretend that praying on your knees with your eyes shut in humility before God, that physically humbling yourself does not affect your spirit, to say that doesn't happen, that's silly. That's ridiculous. To say that receiving communion physically, like Brian, you might have mentioned it, why would God have instituted all of these things if it didn't have some importance? Why would God have a physical priesthood in a physical location? Why would he have given the priests clothes to give them honor and dignity? I mean, he gave them the breastplate with all of these jewels on it. They wore a crown on their head. Tzedek la Yahweh, holy to the Lord, righteous to the Lord. And what does God say? He has done that for Aaron and for his sons so that the people of Israel would respect them, that God would give his priests dignity. so that people would honor them, and that by honoring them, they would honor the sacrifices that they performed, and that honor would redound to the glory of God. What, was God dumb? Was that some kind of primitive form of worship, and now we know better? We know now that that physical sacrifice, that eating a meal doesn't matter? I mean, come on. It does matter, but we've convinced ourselves that it doesn't. We've convinced ourselves that I can watch, you know, John MacArthur preach, sitting in my home, not fellowshipping with others, and that I can grow in my faith. I don't think you can. I've never met a strong Christian who doesn't go to church. I've never met anybody growing in their faith, in real practical righteousness, who's not part of a fellowship. Oh, you might learn a lot of Bible. I've met a lot of people who don't go to church who know all sorts of Bible. But what are you doing? Because if you know that much Bible, you'd know the verse, "Do not forsake the assembling together." Well, you might know a lot of facts, but I don't see much obedience there. Oh, the church is full of hypocrites. Well, we can use one more. If it's so bad, why don't you come and fix it? Don't be a crybaby. Anyways, sorry, I'm just preaching to everybody tonight, and I've gone over time, but does anybody have any final comments before we wrap up? Well, and even that, I mean, part of it is, and I agree with you, but part of it would just be being in the body and having somebody who has, as Gene mentioned, either enough training or enough spiritual perspicuity to say, you don't live by the Ten Commandments, you fraud. You don't meet your own standard. You don't lie. Oh, you honor your parents, and you know, like, it's... Anyways, I'm not. Thank you, everybody.